Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Sophie Reynolds and today I am at the Actors' Church in Covent Garden with Daniel Winder, the Artistic Director of Iris Theatre, who have just opened with a new run of Julius Caesar, which takes place in the grounds of the church and the church itself. And we're going to be talking about the first act of the play. So, Daniel, tell me about the very first scene. How does it open?
The play opens in terms of do you mean my production or do you mean in the...
Let's talk about the text and then come on to the production.
Okay, so the play opens with two non-central characters, really. I'm here with my... I'm just looking them up, actually, because they've disappeared in my low-numbered actors version. But it's Flavius and Marilius, actually. And a range of commoners. And it basically starts with a street scene, which... A bit like the start of Romeo and Juliet, which also has a street scene immediately after... the prologue. And the street scene is sort of establishing the world of the piece, really. It's you're introduced to two characters who seem very at odds with the commoners who were there to celebrate the arrival of Caesar triumphantly returning to Rome. And they are supporters or friends, when it was never quite clear, of Pompey, who Caesar has triumphed over, and they're sort of challenging the audience and challenging the audience's short term memory, and that only a few years ago they were celebrating Pompey and now they're celebrating Caesar. And that is a really interesting first scene because it's a dynamic scene. It has a lot of energy, which is great, and so it's not... It's exposition, but it's quite clever exposition in that it gives a very strong dramatic conflict at the top of the play. And it sets up the idea of the returning triumph of Caesar, but also of this former regime, of the Pompey regime, and the idea that not all people are happy with the change of regime, if we put it that way. So it's quite a tasty little scene. Unfortunately... In the way that the way we've staged it, because we have seven actors, what you have to do is pare back and double up on scenes. So instead of starting with the commoner's reaction to the return of Caesar, the way our piece starts is with a piece of very loud music, very strong physical language, which basically presents the arrival of Caesar back into the streets of Rome. So we sort of see that firsthand. And we get one of the famous speech, which is a beautiful, famous speech, which lots of schoolboys of a certain age will know, which is the "Wherefore rejoice, what conquest brings thee home" speech. I do keep, but we actually give it to Brutus to discuss with the crowd after everyone's left. So Caesar comes through, we see the triumphal arrival of Caesar. We have the soothsayer moment first.
Right, so you've really played with the order quite...
We play with the order, I do this all the time. One of the challenges, one of the joys really of working within a site-specific environment with a Shakespearean text is that, as all these scripts are sort of... the ones that we arrive at and we have in the folio and we treat as like biblical texts, there's all sorts of different versions knocking around. They were actually all working scripts, and so I don't feel guilty about chopping things up and moving them around, because if you look at the versions of Hamlet we've got, it's obvious someone was doing that. And if you look at the versions of even of Caesar, there's two different versions of Caesar that knock around. So I'm very relaxed about chopping things and moving things around. And when you're moving an audience from physical space to physical space, what that sometimes means is that you reorder, so that on the page what often happens is Shakespeare will switch backwards and forwards between two locations. And so as long as you're not messing up the chronology too much, in terms of the narrative chronology, what you do is you amalgamate all the scenes that happen in one place, and then you put all the scenes that happen in another place, and you put them back to back.
Sure, so your audience isn't walking back to
so the audience isn't walking, getting annoyed. And also, just so it works logistically. And what's interesting, as always, because all good directing, I think, a big part of it is about working with limitations and responding to them creatively. That limitation requires you to make interesting and creative choices around the text and around character. And so facing those challenges can be the grit that then a pearl will kind of form around.
I do think it's interesting, the thing you said to start with about how you've had to cut some of your characters, some of the sort of lesser characters, some of the Romans. But as I understand it, you've made the audience into those people. They are your crowd.
Yes. So, but obviously they don't know their lines.
No.
So, you know, you
that
have to...
That would be taking interactive theatre a step further.
You could hand out cards, couldn't you? No, so they don't know their lines. So, I mean, there's a lovely little sequence at the very beginning, back in Act 1, where... the commoners are challenged by Flavius Marilius in terms of what job do you do? Speak to me. And we keep all that, but we address it to the audience. And I've got them having to improvise responses to what the audience says, which you can sort of get away with because this whole first section, a lot of it's in prose. So it's fine. So they can...
So you genuinely ask a member of the audience,
yeah,
what's your job?
What's your trade?
And then
I've sort of edited out... so let me try and find it. So he asks him his trade and then one of the responses, but wherefore art thou not in thy shop today? But all I've... In the script that the actor has, it just says, but wherefore art thou not in thy blank today? And they have to fill in the blank. And there's another one where they... He talks about being a cobbler and he says, well, where is your hammer and your awl or something like that? I can't quite find the line. And he's just got, where is your blank and your blank? And he fills it in. So that's an interesting challenge, which Nick Howard Brown, who's playing Cassius, who actually does that little bit of audience participation, has, is to come up with those off the top of his head. So that's kind of a fun kind of energetic punch into the front of the play. It's quite a... I think it's an extraordinary play. Unlike Hamlet, which has a lot of laughs along the way, it really does, there's very little kind of levity in the play at all. And so it's quite nice, actually, to have a little bit of levity there. I always think that levity is incredibly useful as a key for unlocking the hearts of an audience so that they're ready to receive tragedy. That's what's why Hamlet is an extraordinary play, because you have this opportunity to back-to-back have very funny scenes and then incredibly tragic scenes. And if you can get the audience laughing, then when you pinion a kind of massively tragic scene right next to it, their hearts are a bit more open and then they're really much more affected by it. That's a trick that he plays as a playwright quite often. But in Caesar... there isn't much levity, so, you know, it's nice to try and grab a little bit of levity in Act One before we get into the full conspiracy and the murder and downwards from there. Even the servant characters in Caesar aren't particularly funny, although they are touching. And I think the Brutus-Lucius relationship is incredibly touching, but, yeah, there's not many laughs, so we sort of take that chance to have a little bit of a laugh with the audience.
At the beginning.
Yeah.
So if we move on to scene two in the text, we've got sort of a group scene. We've got Caesar, Antony, Brutus, all of their associates, all their comrades, they're all there, and it's quite a big scene. They're having a celebration, a procession to mark this victory. So in your production, that's the opening scene.
That's right. So that opens the play, and it's a great for a promenade piece where you're encouraging the audience to think of themselves as the people of Rome. It's a great way to start and to establish that premise from the top, really, because it's a processional scene, and they're processing in front of the people of Rome. So there we are, and we set that premise up right at the top of the play.
And then you have the soothsayer, which I think is a really difficult character to deal with.
It's incredibly difficult. I think... I have to be careful what I say, it sounds like I'm criticising Shakespeare, which I wouldn't dare do. There isn't much to go on with the soothsayer, because it doesn't actually say so much. So there's a whole question about how you give enough weight to the soothsayer as an idea. I mean, the men dismiss the soothsayer, and Caesar just calls him a dreamer and leaves him. So But nevertheless, he's an incredibly important character in that he is, his premonitions are correct.
And throughout the play, there's quite a lot of that sort of feeling of superstition and dreams and, and vision. So, I don't know, because your play has a certain contemporary edge. Have you dealt with that? I mean, have you thought about how to make that relevant, or do you just go with it?
Well, I think, I mean, our soothsayer is a bit of a wild-eyed kind of fanatic kind of gas mask covered in fairy lights. I mean, he cuts an odd figure. Did you see the film, is it 12 Monkeys? Oh, it's a great film, 12 Monkeys, with Brad Pitt in it, and he plays this kind of wild-eyed guy who's sort of sent back from the future to modern day New York to try and prevent a great tragedy, and no one believes him. I mean, we're pulling, with the soothsayer, I'm pulling on kind of those images of kind of slightly unhinged, kind of wild-eyed, kind of conspiracy theorist kind of people, you know what I mean? And I think that is relevant. The other thing I do, which we then use as a motif throughout the piece, is there is a, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, there's a wonderful poem, a long epic poem called The Rape of Licorice by Shakespeare, which, funnily enough, is about, in a way, about the founding myth of the Republic. And to give the soothsayer more to say, I take a chunk of The Rape of Lucrece, and actually we use that as a kind of extension of his prediction. So I take that, they're sort of dismissing him, and then using sound and light and future bits of trickery, we sort of expand the scale of the soothsayer, and he sort of speaks like the voice of God. And for those extra lines, because they're not in the original script, I go to the Rape of Lucrece. So, and then we go back and use the Rape of Lucrece again and again throughout the piece as a kind of thing that chimes in at various points, as part of this, as you were saying earlier, this kind of idea of a world within which superstition and destiny and fate is something that is a recurring echo that comes back and back and back again. But I wouldn't want your listeners to think that's an intellectual choice. That's actually really about a feel and about just generating that kind of sense of a kind of slight mystery and slight kind of dark, portentous thing, which comes up again and again throughout, and also in the next scene in Act One, actually.
Which we should move on to. Yeah. So tell me about the next scene in Act One.
Well, the next scene in Act One is really interesting because we have this character called Casca who, in my version, sort of hoovers up all the other smaller parts. Daniel Hannah is doing a wonderful job representing all the other Romans. Casca is a great character anyway, and he starts with this interesting little scene when they're returning from the sport in Act 1, Scene 2. And Casca seems quite matter-of-fact, quite earthy. They're asking about what happened, and he tells them in quite a matter-of-fact way about Caesar being presented with a crown, and he's kind of a blunt, plain-spoken man, and it's even commented upon by Brutus to Cassius immediately after his exit. Then in the next scene, we see Casca again. It's one of the great joys of playing this part. And he's met by Cassius in the storm and in the night. And he seems to be transformed as a character. He's terrified. He's superstitious. He talks about men walking the streets with their arms on fire, piles of horrific women. You know, he meets a lion by the Capitol. It's got all this apocalyptic and extraordinary imagery. And I think that what Shakespeare's doing by putting those two scenes almost back to back is he's representing by allowing us to see the effect on Casca of what he's seen and how much his character is transformed. We begin to get a sense of the scale of this kind of nightmarish storm, which isn't a normal storm. It's a storm full of extraordinarily terrifying and dark imagery, and I think that's sort of, for me, probably the meat of the first act is that journey for Casca between those two scenes.
That's interesting. So do you think also by putting those two scenes together and you see him before and after, that avoids having to actually show the actual storm?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think that the way that works in most classical literature is that, you know, all the way back to the Greek and Roman stuff, where you would have horrific things which would happen off stage, which is the way for geeks, the word obscene comes from, you know, it's too obscene to be seen, it's off stage. And so a messenger would come on and report what's happened. But just from a purely, I mean, the great thing about Shakespeare and the great reason he still gets done and is loved by theatre makers is here's an actor who writes or a theatre maker who writes. So he knows, he doesn't want to give you the problem of trying to stage that. So he very helpfully works out a way to get that story across to the audience without having to stage it, because he knows that would blow your budget. And I'm sure his budgets were as tight as my budgets are. And he's on a blank stage with two pillars. Yeah, I mean, he had a few special effects and he's got his heavens and his hells, but as much as possible, he would try and get the impact across to the audience without having to actually stage it. And I think that's very helpful for us.
And you're on the move for these scenes anyway, so tell me about how that works. Where are you when this scene happens?
Okay, well, the initial arrivals of Caesar in Rome scene and the soothsayer happens in the first space. We then very quickly move. One of the challenges of moving audiences, by the way, is that what it does is it gives you, with a play, there's always the challenge of where do we take the interval and how do we come to a mini climax at the end of the first half and start cleanly at the beginning of the second half, and then how do we bring the play to a close. When you move six times in a production, you basically have that problem six times. So the first scene and the first sequence happens with the arrival in Rome of Caesar and the soothsayer. And then when we move, I've inserted a rather fantastic gypsy knife fight between Casca and Mark Antony, actually, which is like a sport fight. But that's what we move into for the second space that we move into. And so that allows us to punch into the start of the second sequence. And then we do the two Casca scenes, the scene immediately after the sport where Casca's telling Brutus and Cassius about the crowning three times, and then the storm sequence all happens in the same space, so that we get that juxtaposition in one space for the audience to see. And then we move at the end of Act One to a new space by Brutus's house for the start of the conspiracy sequence.
Right. So, thinking about the characters a little bit, tell me about your Caesar, because we don't really see him that much in the first act, but he's obviously a key character, you
mentioned. Yeah, he is. He's, again, and I'm not saying he's underwritten, but he's a bit of a cipher, really, Caesar, in the play, if that's the right word, I'm sure it is. But he's an axis around which things turn. There's not a lot of meat on the bones of Caesar. You get the relationship with Calpurnia, which seems dry at best. He does this very odd thing in Act One where he very publicly asks Mark Antony to touch her during the course because that might cure her barrenness. And I don't think it's just my modern sensibilities that thinks that there's a strange kind of cruelty about that. So in his personal life, there doesn't seem to be an easy personal life. In Act Two, we then see them at home together, and although he yields to her pleading with him to stay at home, he doesn't seem to be particularly respectful of his relationship with his wife, which is very contrasted with Brutus' relationship with Portia. So as a personal man, he doesn't seem to have a very satisfied or happy personal life. In my version, because he's a relatively young man who's playing Caesar, he's a man in the prime of his life who's on the up. And as Brutus describes at the start of Act Two, you know, he's still climbing up the ladder of ambition. Hasn't yet attained the utmost rank, but he's on his way up. So an ambitious man. He's quick to anger. He has that funny bit in Act One when he sees, when he talks about only wanting thin men, not wanting thin men around him. I wish he was fatter, and I don't trust people who think too much. And there's something of the kind of that kind of broad, charming but also slightly dangerous popularism about him. You know, I don't trust intellectuals, I don't trust, you know. If he was a modern politician, he would be one of these guys who goes down the pub and pretends he's one of the man, a man of the people. And yet, he's very untrusting of all the people around him. It's also clear in the little bit he has with Mark Antony after he talks about having men who are fatter around him, that he talks about saying, on the one hand, I'm Caesar and I'm not scared of anything. But on the other hand, if I wasn't Caesar, I would be quite scared of Cassius. So he doesn't, he seems very untrusting and very unsure. And yet, but then in Act Two, when Casca arrives and says the Senate's going to give him a crown, all his doubt and suspicion is overwhelmed by his ambition. And I think that moment before he gets murdered is when he's at his grandest and is most confident and is most self-assured. And he has that this strange speech about being unmoved as the Northern Star, and you know, I was constant that Simba should be banished and constant do I remain. And he's very sort of, he's very, very, he sort of, he, the character journey for that actor is a move. Once you get offered the crown, or it's announced that it's going to be offered to you by Casca when he arrives at his house, that then you grow and grow and grow in confidence right to the peak before you're cut down in your hubris, I think.
So when we hear that story in scene two about how he's offered the crown three times and he turns it down, do you is in your interpretation, is that part of his plan? It's a plot to make people think that he's not after that?
Well, I think that, no, it's more complex than that. I mean, in our version, it's funny that you have long conversations in rehearsals about stuff that isn't on stage, but we did have long conversations about this. And in our imaginations, the idea is this something that perhaps Mark Antony, as the arch-politician, might have set up. But without the backing of the Senate, it's not something that he could actually accept. So it's one thing to have the rabblement, as Casca calls them, hoot and clamour for him to accept a crown. But really, Caesar is clever enough to know, and perhaps Mark Antony's already said to him, don't accept it. He's clever enough to know that he can't accept it without first having the backing of the Senate. So really, it's a, for us, it was always imagined as a piece of political theatre, in that it's really about showing the Senate how much the rabblement want him to be king. So it builds pressure on the Senate to acquiesce to that plan. But it's not until that news is brought to Caesar's house the following morning that that's what's going to happen, that he would then actually go for accepting the crown. So, I think it's rather clever stage-managed politics. The problem that Caesar has, and this is why he leaves in anger, isn't that he's had to reject it. The problem is he falls down and faints, and he's so mortified and embarrassed that at the peak of his, this grand piece of political theatre, where he's meant to be demonstrating to the people that he's this great political leader and this strong man, that he reveals his physical weakness. And I think that that's why he's so shook up by that, and why he leaves with such anger.
And that's obviously something that the conspirators pick up on immediately and have a real problem with, and use to their advantage.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you also need to, again, a conversation which happens in rehearsals, which is about stuff that isn't necessarily on stage, is about talking about who decides when to be part of the conspiracy. So at least in my instinct, Cassius has a very strong and personal problem with Caesar from the very beginning. And he sets off with that very particular aim from the very, you know, the moment we see him and the moment we hear him talking to Brutus, this is what he's plotting. And later on he reveals he's already spoken to several of the members of the Senate, and so this is an active conspiracy for Cassius. Brutus is much more unsure. He's persuaded to some extent in that great scene with Cassius. And the news that Casca brings of Caesar falling down and fainting and having a fainting sickness is also something that I think begins to sway Brutus. What's interesting again about the narrative, and I think it's interesting, is we don't see Brutus make that decision. With the next scene we see, which is post the big storm, which perhaps has had some impact on the mindset of Brutus as well, we go to Brutus's house. And the first line he says is basically, "Tis must be by his death." So he's made his mind up.
But is that part of... There's another layer, isn't there, that we missed out? This plot with the letters that Cassius talks about, throwing letters through Brutus's windows.
You're absolutely right. So there's this sequence that, again, we don't see, but when Brutus leaves, Cassius then reveals his little plot and then sends various people off to post various letters in various places. So it's a combination of all sorts of things that persuade Brutus to join this conspiracy. Caesar, although it's one of his historical plays, is also a tragedy. And in all tragedies, you need a character who makes, or at least one, maybe more, being presented with a choice and then making a fatal choice. And in some ways, Brutus's choice to join the conspiracy is his fatal choice. And we don't say whether or not he makes the right choice in our production. We present all the elements that lead up to him making that choice. So it might have been the letters, it might have been Cassius's persuasion, it might have been the knowledge of Caesar's sickness. A big thing we've not talked about, which is very central and also part of why I brought the rape of Lucrece back into it, is Brutus's history, in that his ancestor Brutus was part of the people who drove out the Tarquin and founded the Republic. And so there's also something about his ancestry being about, being strongly connected and tied in with the Republic. And so the idea of Caesar trying to make himself a king being particularly problematic for someone whose whole family myth is founded around support and continuation of the Republic, really. So there's all sorts of elements, and he has to struggle to make that decision. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense of what Mark Antony says at the very end of the play, where he talks about him being the only one out of all of the conspirators who does it for a noble reason, and who does it out of the best wishes with the purest of hearts, for the good of the people of Rome, even though that might be a misguided choice.
Lovely, thank you very much.
My pleasure.